You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Daniel 7, midpoint of the book. This is where Daniel shifts from all those really cool stories like Daniel in the lion's den, the writing on the wall. You know, some of the most famous stories in the Bible are in the first half of this book. Now we're about to cover what no one teaches usually, all of these prophecies. Daniel is receiving a series of visions, and they're in dreams about the future, predictions about what's going to happen down the road. And I realize the second I say we're going to get into some Bible prophecy, some of you are like, oh no. You know, you're thinking of just the ridiculous billboards. Or you're thinking of like these dudes with a sandwich board on. You're just like, oh, no, why did I come this morning? And I get it. I think a lot of pastors have made overconfident predictions about Bible prophecies that have not come true. And they've made the Bible look absolutely ridiculous. And I really want to avoid that. On the other hand, I don't know if you know this, but over a quarter of the Bible is on prophecy. It is a huge emphasis in Scripture. I couldn't do what I'm supposed to do in a setting like this unless I was willing to teach passages like this, because this isn't some isolated phenomena. It's all over the place. We're going to get into this. It will be challenging. I'm not going to lie. This is tricky stuff. However, here's something unique about Bible prophecy that maybe you don't know about. And this is unlike anything else out there. The Bible does have detailed predictions about the future, but those predictions are understandable because they are often interpreted right there for you in the text. And this is an example of this. You know, in the middle of this chapter, after Daniel has received this, like, this stunning vision of the future, he's blown away. He's like, as for me, my spirit was distressed. The visions in my mind kept alarming me. He's really knocked off balance and bewildered by this. But in the dream, he doesn't just stop there. It says that he approached one of those who were standing by it. If you look earlier, he approached an angel who was standing near God's throne, and he began asking this angel to give him the exact meaning of all this. And so the angel told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Okay, so half this chapter is this crazy vision that's really hard to understand, but the other half is an angel explaining to us what it means. Okay, so this is challenging, but it is doable. Is it going to be confusing? Yes, it will, but there will be an interpretation provided. So just hang with me here. I think we can all stick with this. Okay, so one other thing. There's so many details. The big thing I'm going to focus on in this prophecy is this person called the Little Horn. The Little Horn. The Bible uses horns as a kind of a symbol of kings all the way through. But yeah, there's this king, this Little Horn, and he has a lot to say about this guy. I thought about just saying up front who I think he is, but I think it would be better if you could just look at the text yourself without any preconceptions. And we'll walk through it. And once you've gotten exposed to the text and what it says about the little horn, then we'll talk about who I think it is. And you can see what you think. Okay, you ready? Here we go. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay in his bed. And he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and he sees four great beasts coming up from the sea, different from one another. So it's, you know, he's seeing these crazy huge beasts striding up out of the water toward the beach, water rolling off of them, one after the other, just, you know, uncomfortably close, just watching them go by. And so these four great beasts, we could be like, what could that possibly mean? We don't have to do that because the dream is here in the first half. We have the interpretation in the second half. And if we jump down to verse 17, the angel tells Daniel, these great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. Okay, that's pretty helpful. The beasts are kings that are kind of coming up in succession. And you'll see kind of kings, kingdoms, nations, that's all kind of blurred together here. And so I don't know if you remember, some of you were here back when I covered chapter 2. Where else in this book have we heard about a succession of four kingdoms? Back in chapter 2, right? With the statue. Yeah, if you remember, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream that Daniel interpreted, and in that dream, the head of gold was a symbol of Babylon. The chest and arms of silver was Medo, Persia. That's how people call Media Persia, two different empires that kind of came together, Greece and then Rome. Okay, so the statue parts symbolize kingdoms in chapter 2, and these beasts symbolize four kingdoms in chapter 7. Now, if you remember, back in chapter 2, it was very clear. Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, you, O king of Babylon, are the head of gold. Okay, it's absolutely crystal clear. And when we turn to chapter 7, it is also crystal clear that this first beast, which is a lion that has wings, is also Babylon. Okay, let's just read what it says. The first beast was like a lion. It had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked and it was lifted from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. Okay, a few things here. One, lions. If you were to go to the archaeological site of ancient Babylon and you could walk along some of the promenades that would go through like the Ishtar Gate, some of the main entryways to the city, you would see hundreds of these brick enameled lions all over the place. Okay, this was a very well-known symbol of Babylon. But the dead ringer for this is he talks about how this lion was humiliated, stripped of its power by having its wings plucked. And we know, and this is what matters more than anything, as a reader of Daniel, back in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon's greatest king, was humbled by God, just like we read about here. And that's why scholars of every stripe would agree that in Daniel 7, the first beast, this lion with wings, like we see with the statue of the head of gold in chapter 2, it is the kingdom of Babylon. So they match. Both visions match. Now, moving on, it says, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. Oop. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. Okay, so beast number two, it's a bear, a lopsided bear. And we can say with certainty that this bear refers to Medo-Persia, because in this book, it's crystal clear that the next kingdom that comes after Babylon is Medo-Persia. Check out what was said here. This is what Daniel told the final kingdom of king of Babylon on the night that Babylon fell. He said, your kingdom, this is Belshazzar he's talking to, the Babylonian king, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Okay, so it's very clear in this book, after Babylon, if we're talking about a succession of kingdoms, the next one is Medo-Persia. The other thing that fits Medo-Persia perfectly is it was a lopsided empire. The Persian side was much more powerful than the Median side. And so that fits as well. Okay, so we have two beasts so far. What about the little horn, Mike? I thought that's what we were talking about. Okay, you got to hang with me. We're not going to get to the little horn for a little bit. And partly because Daniel wants you to know when the little horn appears in history. Okay, that's very important. So this is the backstory. You got Babylon, Medo-Persia, and then this third beast. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard that had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Okay, so a four-headed leopard with four wings. Greece. If you go, especially reading the rest of this book, and just knowing from history, or if you've seen the movie 300, like we talked about a few weeks ago, the next kingdom that follows the Persians, the Medo-Persians, is Greece. And again, the imagery fits. You know, a leopard's a ferocious predator. A winged leopard is a fast and ferocious animal. And we know Alexander the Great fits this because he started in Greece, and in 10 years, he conquered territory all the way to India. And this emphasis on four wings, four heads, is a perfect fit for Alexander, because after he died prematurely, his kingdom was eventually divided into four lesser kingdoms. When we get to chapter 8, you'll see that. And I realize, I know I'm going quick. It's a lot to take in. If you're not persuaded that the second and third kingdoms are Medo-Persia and Greece, they are named as such in chapter 8. Well, you'll see next week. That will resolve any doubts about this question when we get into chapter 8. Okay, the fourth beast. That is a creepy, that was the scariest looking one I could find. That is terrifying. It is terrifying. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts. He's not like a lion or like a bear. He's like, I don't know what this is, right? It's different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one. Yes, finally, the little horn. Little horn connected to this fourth kingdom. He says, yeah, while I was contemplating those 10 horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among the 10 horns. And three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. Okay, now what empire is this? Oh, a little bit more about the horn. Behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. Okay, fourth beast. 10 horns coming out of it, and then among those 10 horns, a little horn who boasts about himself. Are you confused at this point? Yeah, you're not alone in your confusion. So is Daniel. Daniel's listening. He's watching this all unfold. He's like, what? And so guess where he goes? He goes to the angel. He says, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast. Like, what's up with that fourth beast? Which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, blah, 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 blah. And I wanted to know about those 10 horns that were on his head and the other horn which came up. That's the little horn, before which three of them fell, namely that horn that had the eyes. He was like, man, that was really creepy. This little talking horn, rah, 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 you know. A mouth uttering great boasts, which is larger in appearance than it gets bigger and bigger, seems like. So yeah, really weird stuff. He's very curious, doesn't know what to think about it, and the angel is happy to explain what it means, okay? Here's the angel talking. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth. Yeah, okay. That makes sense. The beasts have been kingdoms so far. The fourth beast is a kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it'll devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. Okay. Now, just following from history, You got Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and then Rome. So the fourth kingdom in the sequence historically, that would definitely be ancient Rome, the Roman Empire. And in this book, in chapter 11, it is Roman power that conquers the Greek Empire. And so, yeah, the last kingdom, the fourth kingdom is Rome, but he spends a lot of time talking about this fourth kingdom. There's a lot of components to it. One thing you'll notice too, and I just want to jog your memory, back in chapter 2, when we talked about that statue with its four parts that also represents four kingdoms, do you remember the legs were made out of what? They were made out of iron. And here we have these teeth of iron. So this emphasis on iron, you know, we're supposed to pick up, oh, there are similarities here. And obviously, this imagery here of devouring the whole earth and treading it down and crushing it, that totally fits the Roman Empire and its military dominance. And so, yeah, that's it. I wish I could pause now and take a nap. That is just a kind of a whirlwind tour of the main part of this vision. Now, what about these 10 horns? He said, as for the 10 horns out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. Okay, so you've got the beast, it's a fourth kingdom, but he's saying that those 10 horns are also 10 kings. Okay, so you've got the fourth kingdom, and then out of that kingdom comes this alliance, I guess, this grouping of 10 kings. If you remember back in chapter 2, as you travel down in time, down the statue toward the feet and the toes, they also were connected to kings. Look at this. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it'll be a divided kingdom. He's focused on the toes here. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong, some will be brittle. And then look what he says just a couple verses later. In the days of those kings, he's referring to the toes, then God will set up his kingdom. And so both in chapter 2 and in chapter 7, this fourth kingdom has 10 kings coming out of it. In chapter 2, the 10 toes are 10 kings. And in chapter 7, the 10 horns are 10 kings. And again, you're supposed to notice as a reader going through this, wow, these visions, they're matching up. It's like they can be overlaid on each other. That little horn, as for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. And then look what he says, and another will arise after them, and he'll be different from the previous ones and will subdue three kings. So he apparently is around at the same time as these 10 horns, but he's not one of them. He is distinct from them. Okay, so there you go. That's pretty much it. And I just want to catch our breath real quick and just point out two visions, right, with imagery that has four parts to it, pointing to four kingdoms. It's almost like as we're reading this, we're seeing the four beasts in Daniel 7 are kind of building on the four parts of the statue in Daniel 2. Think about Google Maps. Maybe this will help a little bit. So that's outside of Logan, right? I was trying to find somewhere where there weren't advertisements where I could just do this. In Google Maps, you can look at one piece of real estate in different ways, right? Or you could even see the topography. And as you add each of those Google Map layers over the same area, you are getting a richer understanding of what's happening there. Okay, and these visions that we're studying, starting with now, are like Google Map layers, each new one laid over the previous one, matching up and giving us a richer understanding of the flow of human history. That's what's happening here. It's really incredible if you can appreciate this. Both visions are about four kingdoms. That's crystal clear. In both visions, 10 kings come out of the fourth kingdom. And the fourth kingdom in both visions does seem to have two phases. It's interesting. In Daniel 7, 10 horns, that phase of this kingdom, it comes out of the fourth beast, which is ancient Rome. And in Daniel 2, as you're traveling down the statue and forward in time, you've got the legs of iron, but then distinct in composition and further down the statue, you have the feet and toes of iron and clay. I mean, it really does hint that this fourth kingdom that has some kind of connection to ancient Rome has two phases to it. And here's one more thing. I know I'm really kind of pushing the envelope with you guys, but in both of these visions, this 10 kingdom phase of the fourth kingdom actually is terminated by God arriving. It takes us right up to the end of history. Listen to the verbiage again back in Daniel 2, where he's describing the 10 toes on the statue. He says, in the days of those kings, so like while they're still active, the God of heaven will set up his kingdom that will never be destroyed. Okay, so what's going to put the 10 kings out of business that appear toward the end of this fourth empire? It's going to be God himself setting up his eternal kingdom. We see the same thing in Daniel 7 with the 10 horns and the little horn. Listen to this. This is such a, can you just imagine being Daniel seeing this, okay? Still in his dream about the future, Daniel says, I kept looking until the thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took his seat. That's Daniel's way of describing God. His vesture was like white snow, the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, its wheels a burning fire. It's interesting too. You can look at other descriptions of the heavenly throne room throughout the Bible, and they have very notable similarities. Like people are seeing the same thing. He says, a river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him. Those are the angels that I brought up earlier. Myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of that boastful horn, the boastful words that the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Okay, and so right up to the bitter end, you get the sense this little horn, this arrogant, God-hating person is just like, rah! And then he's destroyed. He's wiped out. Apparently, it's like a court scene. These books, we don't know. It was probably a record of the little horn's misdeeds. And then based on that, the sentence is passed, guilty, and he's eliminated. And so, yeah, and then what? What happens after the little horn is taken out? It says, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, the clouds of heaven. With the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him, to the son of man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which won't be destroyed. Which is cool. It's very cool. And for our purposes, for now, what's relevant is that just like in the days of those kings in Daniel 2, God set up his eternal kingdom. Here we see the little horn associated with the 10 horns taken out when God establishes his eternal kingdom. And so in both visions, the 10 king phase of the fourth kingdom ends when God's eternal kingdom begins. That means this little horn, if we're trying to figure out who he is going to appear on the world stage toward the end of history, right before God cruises in and sets up his kingdom. Now, what about this guy? Who are we talking about here? He's powerful, right? He subdues three of those 10 horns. He's appearing at the end of history. He seems to emerge out of a confederacy of 10 kings or kingdoms or nations with ties to ancient Rome. I hope you can see how this is connected to what we've talked about. He's hostile toward God and toward his people. This comes up as the angel starts talking to Daniel. Daniel sees, like, he sees that horn. It's waging war with the saints and overpowering them. And then this angel tells him, yeah, that little horn, he's going to speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. He's going to intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they're going to be given into his hand for time, times, and half a time. Okay, and so this a lot of ominous stuff here. Wearing down. It's just like the little horn is going to have this withering persecution against God's people. The idea that they'll be given into his hand for a period means that God's people are going to be completely at the mercy, at least physically, of this horrible leader for a time, for a period. And, just how powerful will he be? Well, altering, like, the calendar and the legal system, it sounds like he's going to profoundly shape society, like, as we know it. So this is a very powerful person. Who is he? Well, he comes up quite a bit in the Bible. There are over 100 passages on this guy. Not an exaggeration. It comes up a lot. And he has many names. Here, he's called the little horn. In Daniel 9, he's called the prince who is to come. In Daniel 9 again, the one who makes desolate. In Daniel 11, he's the king. Kind of like the Ohio State University. You know, but in a bad way type thing here. He is the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2, the beast in Revelation 13, and he is the Antichrist. That's who we're talking about, a future, powerful, evil ruler with historic ties somehow to the nations emerging out of the old Roman Empire, probably European, maybe a cultural relationship or, you know, geographic ties, but that's who we're talking about. Somebody who is future to us because we have not yet seen God come and establish his kingdom, right? So this guy, he's coming, but he's not here yet. But we can speculate on exactly, you know, what are we looking at? Now, a lot of interpreters would tell you he is kind of a principle of evil in the Bible, kind of this abstract concept of wickedness and rebellion. I don't think so. Okay, these titles really imply we're talking about an actual person, not some kind of principle of evil. I realize the second I say Antichrist, you guys are like, oh, all these crazy movies you've seen. There was actually a movie made where Santa was the Antichrist. Has anybody seen this movie? Yeah, Santa, see how they spell sleigh, see that? The Antichrist loses a bet to some other angelic authority, and so he's got to be Santa for 100 years. And when his time is up, then he reaps havoc on the world, basically. Anyhow, South Park has an Antichrist. Yeah, I know. I realize we kind of push this idea into the ridiculous category because we've seen all this stuff. Also because so many potential Antichrist candidates have been put forward that are not the Antichrist. You got all these people that have at different times been claimed to be the Antichrist. Actually, my top shelf Antichrist candidate, Jim Harbaugh. And his mark, right? Yeah, but he went to the NFL, so I don't know what to think at this point. I don't know what to do with that, so. If anybody tells you they just met the Antichrist, I doubt it. Right? We don't know who he is. But seriously, I don't know if we'll be alive or not. But a generation will see this man come to power. this prediction is going to be fulfilled. This is in the future of humanity here. I know some folks would say, God, that guy is just off, unhinged, holy cow. Well, let me just point out, this book is filled with very detailed predictions, including the rise and fall of these empires that we just talked about, including very detailed predictions we're going to see in chapter 8 and chapter 9 that have been absolutely fulfilled and that were made hundreds of years before the predictions. Okay, this guy is batting 100% on his prophecies and his statements about the future. We have every reason to take what he's saying seriously. And I think if you stay with me on this series, you'll see, wow, okay. If Daniel says the little horn is coming, I need to pay attention. And so what do we do now? You know, if you want to learn more about this, what I would do, I'd probably doom scroll the internet and look up conspiracy theories. That's probably the best thing you could possibly. Okay. Now, how about just reading what the Bible says? Check this passage out. Yeah, let's read this. Revelation 13, 4, the dragon, Satan, if you read back in verse 1, it's clear that, and back in chapter 12, the dragon in the book of Revelation is Satan because the author defines what the symbol means for us, okay? So the dragon, Satan, gives his authority to the beast. Now, I don't know if you caught it back in Daniel 7, at the very end where the little horn dies, Daniel calls him the beast. And so here, John picks up that term. This is John's Revelation's term for the Antichrist. He says, this beast has Satan's authority, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast, who's able to make war with him? There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemes, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemes against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was also given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth worship him. Okay, now does that verbiage sound familiar to you? Right? This language, a mouth speaking arrogant words. I mean, it's verbatim Daniel 7. Waging war against the saints, against God. He's clearly evoking the identical language we just read in Daniel 7. The little horn in Daniel and the beast in Revelation are the same person. That's crystal clear here. Now, think about those Google Maps. You know, as you read different passages that are talking about the same person, it's like getting the topography. It's like getting the satellite view. As we look at these passages, we're getting additional layers of information about who this Antichrist is. And so here's something new. Why is he so arrogant? Why is he blaspheming God? It's because he's energized by God's enemy, Satan. Satan is animating and empowering this guy to be as influential as he is. People worship him. Yeah, all who dwell on the earth worship him. That's huge influence over humanity. He rules the world. He has authority over every people group on earth. And then there's a few other details. I'm not going to read all of it, but it says that if you keep reading in Revelation 13, the Antichrist, the beast, he works hand in hand with this guy called the false prophet. Okay, and the false prophet causes all, the small and the great and the rich and the poor and the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark on their right hand or on their forehead. And he provides that no one will be able to buy or sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. Okay, and so in addition to what we've read, this one way this leader, this little horn, exercises his authority is he's able to control who can participate in the economy, and he does it by demanding that anyone who wants to go to the grocery store and buy something has to have a mark of allegiance. There's some kind of mark to make it okay for them to use money to buy things. So yeah, that's kind of the description of what this guy is like. And it just makes you wonder, when you think about all these different things. Yeah, I'm just going to throw them out here. Yeah, single leader arising from a loose alliance of 10 kingdoms, because they don't really adhere together according to Daniel 2, right? They have historic cultural ties to the fourth empire, to the ancient Rome. This guy's hostile to God and his people and so on. You know, it's okay, that's the Bible's picture, but is something like this plausible? Like, could you imagine this actually happening in our future? Controlling everyone's participation in the economy, seriously? Well, let's just ask and answer a couple questions here. Are there humans who would rule the world if they could? Oh, yeah. We've seen that just a few times. I mean, all the way back to Nero, and you think about like Genghis Khan or Alexander the Great or Napoleon Bonaparte or Hitler. Of course, right? This, nothing could be more typical in human history to see people wanting to rise up and do this. So that's not, I can get my brain around that. Are there people who actually want to be worshipped? Oh, yeah. Truth be told, sometimes I'd like to be worshipped, you know? I really like to be praised and respected. And so this is pretty crazy to put yourself forward as a god. But I mean, even in our own day, North Korean leaders are viewed by North Koreans as gods. I forget which one of their leaders, the rap on him is he played golf for the first time and scored 11 holes in one. He bowled a perfect 300 the first time he went bowling. That he invented the hamburger. Not joking. And you know, you talk to people that have come out of North Korea and they're like, yeah, this culture and our thoughts are so controlled, many people actually revere their leader as a deity. So yeah, that's plausible. Have we seen leaders in the past who are hostile to people who follow God? I mean, come on. There are so many countries even today where if you profess faith in Christ, it will cost you your life. So yes, of course, that's the thing. Are the tools in place to set up a police state where all buying and selling is controlled across the globe? You know, I can't remember the last time I used my cash. I don't even carry cash. I honestly can't remember the last time I handed somebody like change or something. I just don't use cash anymore. There is. Right now, a global financial system. Just anywhere you go, you can use credit anywhere on the planet. Now, it's a big planet, and I bet there'd be a few more things to get there, but is this plausible? I mean, if there was ever, 50 years ago, this is crazy talk, but today, it's like, of course this is possible. Okay, global government. I would have to say that the current trend is really more toward nationalism. I don't know what you guys think, but I think a lot of countries, alliances are getting shaken up, and I think a lot of countries are kind of like, I've got to figure this out. However, global challenges will have a powerful effect on driving countries together. I mean, think about just how we had a dress rehearsal with a global pandemic with COVID. I mean, that was bad. It was really bad, but nothing is not nearly as bad as it could have been. If you had a more contagious, more virulent disease spreading, would we need to cross borders in order to control it and have a higher authority? I think that's a possibility. Think about climate change. This is Jorgen Randers. He's a climate strategist. He writes about what is it really going to take to get countries to cooperate, to bring down global temperatures. He says the prime example is the climate challenge. It's truly a global problem. The temperature will rise everywhere, irrespective of who was the source of the emissions. Such a truly global, truly long-term problem, it's hard to solve if one restricts yourself to using the powers of the free market only. He's just saying, We can't deal with this problem unless a higher authority is making nation states do what needs to be done. Global problems like that, or like the threat of nuclear terrorism, those kind of things, they're difficult to solve without a global government. And so, yeah, That's something to consider. What about are European nations with cultural and geographic ties to the Roman Empire inclined to come together again? Well, that's already happened. Now, I realize, you know, the EU has 27 countries. That's not 10. And who knows, maybe it's a cultural alliance, you know, the West. It's hard to say. All I'm saying, though, is the idea that there are nations with Europe with roots in the historic Roman Empire working together, collaborating, that trend is increasing. Think about Russian incursion into the Ukraine. Think about how we're backpedaling, our country is backpedaling from supporting Europe. There's a policy institute called Bruegel. It's in Belgium. It's a super well-respected advisor to the EU. It's a think tank. And this is their recommendation for European nations. They say Europe faces a grave security threat. Gaps in European military equipment reflect the combination of past reliance on the United States and Europe's nationally based defense governance. Europe must accelerate rearmament through deeper cooperation and innovative governance to counter Russia's aggression and shifting U.S. policies. So Europe has never been more motivated than it is now to figure out how to come up with a common military. And if they do, if that becomes a very firm military alliance, I wouldn't doubt that the number of countries participating might drop. Who knows? I'm just saying, when I look at this and I think, is it plausible? I'm like, yeah, very plausible. And what's crazy is that this is a vision of the future that's 2,500 years old. If you go all the way back to Daniel, that is unbelievable. That these prophecies, these layers, have given us this composite picture that is so plausible. You should think, why is that? It's because God is the author of Scripture. That's why. Well, what should we do? I know some of us, you know, we hear this stuff and we're like, I just don't want to go at any more teachings like this. I don't want to think about any of this stuff. I just want to crawl under my comforter, right? And this is their favorite verse. And it's a great verse. It's about when Jesus comes back. It says, of the day and the hour, nobody knows, not even the angels, nor the Son, but the Father alone. They're like, let's just quit thinking about this because nobody knows when Jesus is coming back. And you know what? In one sense, they're right. We don't know when Christ is coming back. We just don't. However, same guy, same talk, just as over in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus tells us, even so, you too, when you see these things happening, recognize that he's near, right at the door. Okay, so no, we don't want to be an idiot and say Jesus is coming back in 2027, but we do want to be students of the Bible, students of our culture, who can recognize when things are heading toward what we're describing. This is not a good time, just my personal opinion. I'm not saying it's the end of the world, but this is a really bad time to have no interest in Bible prophecy. If there was ever a time to be dialed into this, it's now. I'll just say that. That's what I think. Yeah, so one thing you could do is just recognize God loves you, and that's why he's helping you understand the future. Wouldn't you want to do this for your kids, to prepare them for what's coming? Why not read some of these passages that talk about the future, what's lying ahead for humanity? Read that stuff and try to understand it. And I get it. It's confusing, but you have resources on our website. There are some dynamite books out there. I don't know about that one by Rochford, but the other ones are pretty good. Nah. I really like these three books because they're very clear, they're well footnoted, and they show a little bit of restraint and kind of back away from some of the crazy speculation. And so if you're reading some of these passages I'm recommending here, these books can help. Okay, one last thing for you guys. And if you forget everything I said, this is the most important thing you could do with this material. It would be to turn to Jesus Christ. Now you're like, wait a minute, that's a hard shift. Where did Jesus come up in all this? Well, I don't know if you noticed, when the Ancient of Days was there, this guy called the Son of Man showed up, and the Son of Man was given dominion. The Son of Man, where have I heard that before? That is a term Jesus loved to use about himself. He called himself the Son of Man 84 times in the Gospels, okay? This is his favorite way of describing himself. You know, when you think about who's that guy that's going to come on the clouds of heaven and roll in and set up God's kingdom, that guy is Jesus Christ. That's how he saw himself. That's what he says. Look, he tells his disciples, the Son of Man, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and glory. And the whole point of this talk he's giving is, I'm that guy. I'm coming back. And so I know things are unhinged. People are worried and unsettled by just how upended everything is right now. And I can't fix that, but I can tell you this. The king, the foundation you want to build your life on, the person who's telling us the future before it happens, Jesus Christ, that's where we need to be dialed in. That's who we need to be close to. And if you call out to him right now and just say, I want a relationship with you, I want to follow you, I want to align myself with you, you won't have to ultimately worry about these things because you will be with him in eternity forever. And I really hope you reach out to him and consider that, because he's real and he wants to know you. So don't forget, you got to pick your side while you can. Jesus wins and the little horn loses. So, okay. Father, man, we've just scratched the surface, and there's so much more we could talk about. But this big picture, Lord, that we can, like Bill said, we can be with you forever, that you're the solid rock that we need and that we can stand on, and that you've given us reason to believe that you are the Lord of history, that you know the future before it happens, and that when you say these things, they're trustworthy, and that you loved us enough to die for us to boot. I just thank you, Jesus, that you've made yourself available to anyone who has the humility to turn to you. And I pray that would be the next step, maybe for some folks here, would be to just turn to you and put their trust in you. Amen.